It is the last Monday of the month, and that means it's time to take a look at the weather and climate. We have our weather guys with us once again. As always, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, also professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Great to have you back, Steve.
Good to be back on this last Monday and last day.
John Martin there, too, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences.
Good to be here, Larry.
Good to have you. Happy Halloween.
Yeah, happy Halloween. You're dressed really scary.
Yeah.
I always, I don't have to do anything. Yeah. I can just show up and, oh, man. So you trick-or-treating tonight?
No, I am not. My son is dead against it. He's 16 going on 17. He's uninterested. So it's like a cliff that kids go off of after about 12 or 13, and he's in free fall right now, yeah. As far as that goes.
I'm not going, but I bought a lot of good candy.
Yeah, so do we. we have a low traffic neighborhood, too.
So do we.
In 20 years of experience.
Right.
Well, I tell you what. So the weather's pretty nice across the state for Halloween tonight?
Yeah, it'll be pretty good. I think it's, chilly is not really a good adjective at this time of year. You know it's going to be in the 40s or something like that. So aside from that, pretty good weather. Yeah.
If you have fairy wings, you should be able to wear them in your costume.
I would think so, yeah.
My daughter is going as a raccoon.
Oh, that's a great one.
My wife made the costume, and it is a really cool costume.
Oh. Excellent. Keep her away from rain drains. Those guys like to hang out down there.
Like to crawl down there.
Well, some people saw, by the way, I should give the number. If you want to join in and have a weather or climate question, the number, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Maybe you've got a cool photo, weather photo, that you want to post, or maybe just have a question that you want to post. You can post it right there. Northern Lights. Did you see the Northern Lights last week?
I missed it by about an hour.
Our camera on the roof. Black and white camera.
Right. That's
caught
right,
a glimpse of the evanescence, but no, I didn't see it either.
Yeah.
Wish I'd known it was coming.
Yeah, it got all the way down to Missouri.
Is that right?
Pretty far, yeah. And I saw some really spectacular pictures that people
Yeah, I saw some really, and I'm so sorry. I just didn't know it was coming.
Yeah.
Me either. Now apparently I found out in the aftermath that you can sign up for getting a text message, if there's something imminent or something.
It's $5 a month.
Is it?
Yeah, because I went and looked at it, and I thought, $5 a month. I guess
I thought it was free.
It used to be free. I remember when I first signed up for it, and that was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. It was definitely free. Spaceweather.com.
Yeah,
but now it's $5.
Budget cuts.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to guess.
$5 a month.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah.
But, if you see one a year, it's probably worth it.
They are
pretty rare.
And it's dramatic. Yeah. It's always dramatic.
Well, I'm sorry that I didn't see it, because it's been probably 5 years since I've seen one.
About the same for me, too. Yeah, I think so.
Right. Yeah.
Well, what will Wisconsin forecasts be looking like for fall and winter?
Winter is looking to be a little bit, particularly northern Wisconsin, colder than what we would normally expect.
Yeah.
And that's because La Nina is kicking in.
Yeah.
And that usually means a colder winter for us.
And they don't. I don't think the signal's very strong.
No, it's not as strong as last year.
Yeah. But colder, and I think I saw 50-50 chance for precipitation. So a pretty decent winter, I guess, is what's coming.
So there is a La Nina.
There's a La Nina strengthening up again, although it's not predicted to get as strong as it did last year.
Oh, because I didn't think there was any.
No, I'm kind of surprised, too, because it's like back-to-back. And I guess that doesn't happen that often.
Yeah.
And usually when they have them back-to-back, that second one isn't as strong as the first one either.
Does that have much of an impact in other... I mean, I assume it must have some impact in other parts of the country.
Northwest generally means it's more rainier. And I think the southeast also gets more rainier.
I think they're drier, aren't they?
I'm sorry, right. Yeah, they're drier.
They're wetter with a stronger subtropical jet, which is characteristic of the El Nino, but the La Nina, the opposite. They tend to be drier in the southeast.
Yeah. Okay, so
Texas, it doesn't look good for Texas. Texas doesn't seem to be coming out of its drought, and this won't help.
Yeah.
Climatologically, it won't help.
Oh, man. And Florida?
Same thing.
Same thing?
Yeah, North Florida especially tends toward a droughty period with a strong La Nina in the wintertime.
You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments as we talk weather and climate with our two guests, our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. We are supposed to have had a launch of a new weather satellite. Was that last week?
Yes, that was this past Friday. Mm. A successful launch.
Did it work?
Finally, yeah, it did. And that we won't know completely if how the instruments are working for another, for maybe about another 3 or 4 weeks. So they keep it all buttoned up still to make sure no contaminants can get on any of the filters or anything. But the launch was successful. A number of people here at Wisconsin are involved with it in terms of checking out two of the instruments, a sounder and an imager, and are developing products to improve weather forecasting and climate monitoring.
So now what kinds of things go on one of these satellites, and how high do they go? How high did this one go?
This one's a polar orbiter, and they're usually around 840 kilometers.
Okay.
Multiply that
so
by
500-ish miles.
Yeah, 500 miles thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah. And this one, the three instruments that I'm familiar with are an imager, and so it gives really nice pictures, but also is really good for looking at clouds and aerosols.
Okay.
There's a sounder, which a lot of people in Wisconsin have been involved with in the design, actually, of that instrument. The first, if you can think of it as sketches, if you will, the prototypes. And that's to get temperature and moisture profiles of the atmosphere, which is really good for weather forecasting. And then there's an energy budget one to measure the outgoing and incoming energy at the top of the atmosphere, which really drives a lot of what our climate's about. Mm. So those are the three, and I suspect there's probably another instrument that I'm forgetting.
Yeah, it should help.
It should help, yeah. Yeah, these polar orbiters are good because they get global coverage, and that data feeds into numerical weather prediction models.
And it's polar orbiters, you mean they...
They go around the pole, from North Pole to South Pole.
Oh.
As opposed to the ones we see on the evening news, those are geostationary. They're fixed, kind of.
Yeah, they're farther away, too. They're, 23,000 miles or something?
35,000 kilometers, whatever.
Yeah, that's about 23,000 miles, yeah.
Holy cow. So that's a long ways away.
That's a long ways away.
Rich in Cumberland has a question or comment for you, so let's go there. Hi, Rich. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Couple comments. I haul honeybees to Texas in the winter, and I've talked to a guy down there. He's been there his whole life, 65 years or whatever. He said it's the driest he has ever seen it his whole life down there, southeast Texas, North Beaumont. Really bad. The other comment is I was looking at a study, I think it was University of Wisconsin, about the kind of impact and trends of climate change and the things going out of sync and this and that. And this group working on tracking those kind of changes, and there were some comments about proactive things that could be done. And I'm just wondering if there's more accessible or more easily accessible information about that so the average person in Wisconsin can get tuned into it.
Hmm. One source, and it may be related to what you're talking about with the second question or comment about the Wisconsin study, is there's a great organization known as the Wisconsin Institute for Climate Change Impacts, WICCI, WICCI.
Yeah, that's exactly what this is.
Yeah, I believe they have a website where you can probably find a lot of literature and probably some of it translated into the vernacular for anybody who's interested and not just for scientific peer review that describes some of these things. This is a really interesting cooperative working relationship between a lot of great science and policy departments here on campus, as well as the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Tourism, all kinds of other things. We're specifically geared to looking at how can we use the science that we know about with respect to weather and climate, and particularly the climate system, telescope it down to, you know, the Western Great Lakes regions, Wisconsin in particular, and then start to talk about impacts that these changes are having on tourism, on fisheries, and various other things. And it is quite fascinating. And I'm quite certain this will be a model for a national way to do this business.
It is really fascinating. It'd be a great topic. I wish there was, maybe it's just too early, some way that people out scattered around the state might be able to maybe make observations and report them and that kind of stuff.
I think that the structure of this organization is set up to actually take full advantage of that kind of an effort. So it's absolutely going to happen in the future. I don't know if it's long enough in the tooth yet to have incorporated that.
Oh, there we go.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Rich. Barbara in Dollstown, we are on to you. Hi, Barbara.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
The weather person said some comment about specifically about northern Wisconsin, and I would like to have something geared to southern Wisconsin, specifically according about how severe the winter is supposed to be.
The southern part of Wisconsin, looking at the winter, they're predicting now to be a little bit below normal. But
colder, a little colder?
A little bit colder, yeah, but not, you know, not too much colder. It's really okay. The northern part of the states that they're looking to be much colder than.
Okay, and how about snowfall in the south?
Snowfall, you know, it's a flip of the coin in terms of normal, above normal, or below normal.
So they don't know.
So we don't really know. But rather than say we don't know, we'd like to say a flip of the coin.
Yeah. Right. Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And what is normal temperature, and average winter temperature for?
For the whole winter, I'm not sure. I know that the coldest month is February, I believe, and because it's the shortest one and it starts out really cold, so it tends to be the coldest one. I think the average temperature in February here in Madison is somewhere in the mid-20s, average being the average high and the average low, average together, something like that. So getting close to 10 degrees below the freezing point is sort of an average temperature in the middle of the winter around here.
And then the northern part of the state, it would be colder.
Probably even 10 colder. Degrees colder than that,
I was going to say 10, I bet.
Yep. Yeah.
At least.
Yep.
But it's good cold.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no other kind.
It's a dry cold.
It's a dry cold.
Brad in McHenry, Illinois, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I just had a question. It appears as though if you have an evening that goes down even 33 or 35 degrees, you can still get a frost. And I don't understand the concept of how you can get a frost if water freezes at 32.
That's a good question.
And the reason is that the measurements that we're getting those temperatures at are like, what are they, a meter and a half above the ground, 3-4 feet above the ground?
Yeah, officially they have to be 3 meters above the ground. But most of them are a little lower than that.
Yeah. So we're measuring the temperature that's higher up from the ground. And during these nights when you get frost, the temperature increases as you get further away from the ground. So even though the temperature is 34, 35 at the station, at the ground, it's usually below freezing.
Yeah, I had a vivid example of that once when I was in Seattle as a graduate student. We had these handheld thermistors, and I was holding it up at about my eye level. Temperature was about 39 degrees, so way above the freezing point. And by accident, I dropped it. It's connected to a wire to the thermometer. I dropped it, and suddenly I looked at the thermometer again, and the temperature was 29. I said, what the heck happened here? And then I noticed that the thermistor was an inch from the ground, and it's 10 degrees colder on a clear, still night,
maybe
6 feet away from the ground. It's unbelievable. That really opened my eyes.
And we'll have more unbelievable information. You stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Weather is the backdrop for pretty much everything we do, but sometimes it really asserts itself and moves to center stage. And when it creates something like a sighting of the Northern Lights, we're real happy when it does. Larry Mueller here. Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. My guests for the next half hour today are my weather guys from UW-Madison, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. And they'll share what they know about climate and weather. And, of course, they're happy to answer your questions when you call in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Don't forget to check our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show for updates and to post your comments and weather photos as well. And if you like the page while you're there, we'll give you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at climate and weather here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my favorite weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John's a chair there, and Steve is also director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Questions for them or comments? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. If you got a cool weather photo, we'd love to see that as well. You can post that on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we've had some really cool ones over the last year. So Don't be bashful. Go ahead and post those photos. We'll take a look at them. David in Pound, Wisconsin, has a question for you guys. So let's go there. Hi, David.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, you always hear about records from like the 1870s or 1880s. How accurate are them, and can you always stick by them?
Yeah, I think that especially temperature records, I think, are probably pretty accurate. They had pretty decent instruments even as early as the early 1700s, but certainly in the 1800s after the Signal Service was initiated by President Grant, there was a fairly big effort across the country to make sure that those instruments were reporting accurate measurements. So I think especially when it comes to temperature measurements, they're pretty good. And it's possible to make some sense of where they may have errors as well. And I think a lot of times when a 100-year data set is used by climate scientists to try and make a statement about how things are now compared to in the past, they have to be very careful to make sure that they do as much of that calibration and cross-checking as possible. And so sometimes little adjustments can be made to those records. But by and large, they're pretty solid.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the temperature measurements were accurate, and I think they had guidelines of where to place them by then, too.
Yeah.
Right, which would also be important.
Right. Yeah. So a lot of the stuff that's standardized now was on the list of standardization then, but not all of it, but a lot of it.
There you go. Thanks, David, for calling. Peter in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm a skier, and I want to go out west once this winter, and I have a choice between northern New Mexico, Colorado, or Montana. Given the La Nina, what is your recommendation for big snow?
That's a good question. I guess I wouldn't go to New Mexico. I don't know if I have a good reason to say that. I think the further south you go, though, with the La Nina, maybe you're not going to be in a situation where the snows will be as good as they would be in Colorado. And Montana may be just cold and dry. Comparatively.
Okay.
Yeah. So of the three, my guess would be Colorado. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd stay out of New Mexico, too, just because the drought in that part of the area.
All right. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Happy skiing. Yeah. We had a caller who saw the northern lights from an airplane flying towards St. John's, Newfoundland. The light appeared to be below them.
Yeah.
How cool would that be? Mm-hmm. Even out towards the horizon, it appeared to be below them. Is that really possible? How could that be?
Probably not, because the aurora borealis, where the oxygen and nitrogen molecules and atoms are getting excited, is like up 50 miles up in the atmosphere.
Okay.
So they're not flying that high.
No.
But if they're looking out to the horizon, it's probably a matter of perspective.
It could very well
looks
be,
like that you're looking down. But it would be, I've seen photos of it, and it looks like a curtain then in that case.
Yeah.
You can really see the line of it. But that would be really nice to be
even
up
when you're
there.
On the ground, it seems like that curtain hits the top of trees. So
right,
it's, even from that place where you feel like it's the more common perspective, you can be fooled. So maybe that is what it is.
And somebody wanted you to repeat the, where do you sign up and have to pay to get the alerts about the Northern Lights?
Spaceweather.com.
Spaceweather.com.
If you search on that, it's right on their front page. $4.99. Though I looked at it recently after I missed it.
Oh, we got a Facebook question from Bob. What was the cause of the large high pressure off the East Coast about a month ago that blocked our low and high pressure systems from moving through? Why did it linger so long?
I'm not sure I exactly remember that particular feature, but these blocking highs, they're called, are a phenomenon of the autumn. They do happen in the autumn with some degree of regularity, which means, every couple of years you get one that's noteworthy by standards that maybe you could measure. I don't know if this one met that criteria, but they do tend to be fairly stationary features. They long-lived. They're big anticyclones. Their cousin on Jupiter is the Great Red Spot. It's exactly the same kind of thing as the Great Red Spot, a big anticyclone. And that's been around for more than 300 years. Now, it's a whole different atmosphere, of course. But these anticyclones that form on that scale, both north, south, and east, west scale, is very large. They do tend to sit around in one spot for quite a good long time. And there are some, pretty easy to understand reasons why that's true. They're sort of hard to describe in a few words, I can tell you that. But we do understand something about their longevity.
We have, by the way, you can join in if you have a question or comment. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quick here. 1-800-642-1234. Caller from Evansville would like you to talk about what causes a whiteout.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think what you need is strong winds and fluffy snow on the ground in order to get the visibility to be blocked out. So we haven't had them yet. I guess we could have dust outs. There were some really nasty dust storms in Texas that, again, decreased visibility. Yeah. Actually, so now I'm fog, I don't think, causes a whiteout in terms of meteorological definition.
Right, that's right. I think it has to do with blowing snow.
Yeah, so it's probably associated with blizzard-type conditions where you have blowing snow and wind speeds above something.
40 miles per hour, I think.
Something like that.
Temperature below 20. And it doesn't have to be actually snowing.
That's right.
To have blizzard conditions, and certainly not to have whiteout conditions.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very cool. Jeff in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, gentlemen, actually. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just wanted to say how much I enjoy this segment, along with your birding, Larry. This is my two favorite passions. But wanted to ask the gentleman, now that we have the long-range analysis in place from the National Weather Service for our winter here, this apparently is a double La Nina event for us. And what is your thoughts on what we've seen in past winters with the back-to-back La Ninas in our area, and what do you think?
When they generally go back-to-back, the second one is usually weaker. And so the impact on us in terms of Wisconsin is also generally weaker.
Okay.
So even though they're forecasting, you know, much colder temperatures than normal for northern Wisconsin, I'd still wait a month before I actually, you know, plan a ski trip or figure out what to do. Yeah. I mean, that seasonal forecasting is really hard. Unless you have a really strong signal.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing that I start to keep my eye on at this time of year is the snowfall in northwest Canada. Mm. And I like to, if the snow starts to accumulate in the Yukon Territory and northern British Columbia, that's a pretty good physical cause for us to have an expectation it'll be cold here in the subsequent month or two. If that doesn't happen to, you know, levels that are above the average, then I'm not so sure it's going to set itself up. So that's what I'm starting to look at now, is where is it snowing in Western Canada?
Well, and my personal opinion, just from living in the Madison area for close to 20 years, is I don't believe yet we've had two winters that were very close. So I agree with you, fellas. I think, we could definitely, we always get the chance for the big winter storm. We always get cold air invasions. But it is a good thing to say that the jury is still out. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, gentlemen, thanks for your time and have a good day.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, on the Facebook page, we've got William sent us some photos of the other night when we had the Northern Lights.
Yeah, that's
the green color.
Those are pretty good, and you can bet that they looked better without that camera in front of your eye. I mean, they're more vivid, I'm sure.
Yeah,
they look pretty good even without with that.
Red over here.
And so you can see the red up, and this is usually the sequence of the colors. You get red up above if you have red with green down below, and they're. Both those colors can be generated by oxygen, the interaction of the solar rays with oxygen.
So there we go. So if you want to see see what you missed,
go to our Facebook page.
Yeah. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Wheeler Show. You'll find it right there. Oh, man. Brandon in Sussex. Let's go to you now. Hi, Brandon.
Hi. How are you guys doing this afternoon?
Great. Thank you for calling.
I had a question, and I'm not exactly sure what to call it. When I was visiting my parents in Kenosha about a month ago, there were trees, like large oak trees, power lines, everything were down around town, and what they described it as was a sudden, like a sudden updraft that made all these things come up from the ground. And I was wondering, one, if you remember what I'm talking about, two, what is that called and what causes it?
My guess would be it probably would have been a sudden downdraft that actually did the damage. That may have immediately followed a sudden updraft. So people might have seen, you know, some leaves that might have been on the ground suddenly go up, and then a second or two later, some really strong downdraft would be the thing that would do the damage, knocking trees and power lines over. I guess I'd probably think it's one of those straight line wind events associated with a thunderstorm, probably in the area.
Okay.
Yeah. When damage is done by an updraft, it's generally a tornado.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's part of the updraft.
Yeah.
Otherwise, usually it's downdrafts coming out of these storms. And but so I haven't heard about it. I don't remember.
Yeah, me either.
So a straight line wind. Maybe you can explain that for Brandon.
Yeah, that's in a thunderstorm environment. There's updrafts of air that form the cloud and the precipitation, and downdrafts of air. The air is processed by the thunderstorm itself, and those downdrafts can be very, very heavy relative to the air around them. And not only that, but they can mix air that's at the top of the thunderstorm that has very, very high horizontal wind speeds. They bring that air right down to the ground. It hits the ground and then flares out after it makes contact, and it keeps its momentum. And so it can hit the ground with horizontal winds of 70 miles per hour or more. And it can be sudden, very sudden. And
right.
then they're straight lines. They don't have any rotation to them, and they can just knock things over.
Mm-hmm. And they can also be very local, too,
yeah,
which
right.
is why
That's
we
right.
might not have heard about it.
I guess I was just amazed because I hadn't been down there for a few months, and I there were trees. I mean, you're talking great giant oak and pine and
yeah.
things that it looked like a tornado ripped through town. So, all right, thank you very much,
gentlemen. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Mike in Tomahawk, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Hey, how come I have seen it snow before at 40 and 42 degrees and actually come down and stick to the ground like last year we had that 20 inches of snow here, and it was 38, 40 degrees. And then there's times I've seen snow or rain at 32 degrees.
Hmm. Yeah. It's an interesting question. The temperature that surrounds a precipitation particle is affected by evaporation of liquid water if it's a raindrop, or affected by sublimation, that is ice turning to water vapor if it's a piece of ice. And the process by which that evaporation or sublimation occurs robs heat from the air that surrounds that precipitation particle. So if you have a lot of snowflakes falling into air that is not saturated, so fairly dry, but relatively warm, 40 degrees or so, you might have enough sublimation occurring right around the vicinity of that snowflake to keep the air that's immediately in contact with that snowflake cold enough to sustain it as a piece of ice. And it won't last for long unless the intensity of the snow is such that there's so much of that going on that the air temperature of the whole air column in the vicinity goes down a little bit as a result of that sublimation of ice. So that's really what's going on there. And it's very, very interesting.
Yeah,
that sounded very interesting. Yeah, because I was, there's times they say precipitation's coming and you think it's at 40 degrees, you think, oh, good, it's going to be all rain. And then you wake up the next morning, there's 6 inches of wet, heavy snow.
Yeah, a key thing you can do if you have a doubt about what form it might be, or if you're starting to hear that in the broadcast, they don't know if it'll be rain or snow, is to, just before it begins or hours before it begins, check the dew point temperature somehow, either on a website that we have here at our university or some other place. If the temperature is 40 and the dew point is 20, then you can bet you're going to see a lot of that precipitation hit the ground as snow. If the temperature is 40 and the dew point's 35, it'll all be rain, guaranteed.
Okay. There you go.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You bet. And
so my memory of those storms is that that's oftentimes when you get these big flakes, too.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
That's right. They're kind of melting a little bit, and they stick together, and they turn out to be the size of pancakes.
Maybe that's what it is.
Something.
They stick, so when they hit, they can accumulate.
Very cool. We have an email from Bill in Madison. Are we heading towards a second La Nina winter? Statistics indicate that second La Ninas produce milder winters than the firsts. Jeff Craven of Milwaukee Sullivan National Weather Service has found several times when there have been consecutive La Nina winters, each time the second La Nina was close to normal. Therefore, he's indicated there's a strong possibility that this year will be nowhere near as tough as others have predicted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that sounds like what Steve's been saying.
Right, yeah. And I trust Jeff.
Yeah.
I believe him over me.
He's a good guy. He knows what he's doing.
He sure does.
He knows what he's doing.
Doug emailed us and says, I'm a bit curious about the temperature in Antigo. Living in Appleton, I see the weather forecasts of the temperature of all the area cities. I can't help notice that Antigo seems to always have the coldest temperatures. Even cities north of Antigo always seem to be warmer. Is there a reason for this? Is Antigo the coldest place in Wisconsin? Well, pretty flat around Antigo.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the coldest
Central
place.
Central Sands area. There.
Our own airport here in Madison routinely has a temperature, the official recording station, that's much colder than just about anybody else who observes the temperature on a regular basis in the area, because it's a little bit lower elevation than everywhere else. And the consequence is on a cold night, the cold air kind of pools, in these low spots. And I don't know if the Antigo reporting station has a similar, you know, situation within the background of a fairly flat part of the state. It might be a local minimum in elevation, and that can make a huge difference on cold mornings.
Yeah, that cold air just drains down there.
Yeah.
As you learn with your thermistor.
Yeah, right, right. It can be 10 degrees colder on a morning. That's routinely the case here at Madison. I'll come into work and say, wow, it was cold this morning, minus one. And then you look at the observation, it was minus eight at the airport. Right. Yeah. Nowhere near that cold at my house.
Yeah.
So...
there you go. I've got Jack in Superior waiting with a question. Jack, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
How many more 30-inch snowstorms on the East Coast this winter?
Ah.
Whew, that's a specific question.
And I'm going to let John get that question.
Yeah, all right, I'll give that
a crack. Hoping for a lot.
Yeah, I like that kind of weather. 30 inches in one storm, is that what you mean, Jack?
Well, they have a lot of snow in one storm this right now. But how many more for the whole winter?
Yeah, I'd say that you probably average once the end of November comes through and you start December, January, February, you average about two or three or four such possibilities per month somewhere along the East Coast. So I'd say between 10 and 15.
Total snowfall for the East Coast.
Well, let me pick the highest point. I don't know where it will be, but one spot along the east coast of the United States will have 90 inches of snow by the end of the winter.
Wow.
That sounds kind of low.
That's pretty specific.
It is kind of low. It's not particularly high.
Sure, it's not 91?
Yeah. Boston averages
180.
No, I don't think there'll be anybody who gets hammered like that. Now, you can't count Buffalo and Syracuse and places like that on the east coast. That's
Buffalo?
Not fair. I'm talking about the Atlantic coast. And, in such a, you know, such a case, a pretty good winter, a snowy winter in Boston is 90 inches. A sort of an average winter up near north of Portland is about 90 inches. So there's a huge variation. So that's why I can say that and be fairly confident I'll be right.
and so it's heavy snow. That's why it's less. It's very wet and packed.
It can be, yeah. But they just get more of them. The storm track in the northern hemisphere along the Atlantic coast is at a maximum in the wintertime. So they just get a lot of events. And they're usually big ones. 6 inches or more is not uncommon. It's very rare here. It's not uncommon.
Yeah, I never would have guessed that many. So I'm glad we gave it to you.
Yeah.
Because I would have been wrong.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Rita in Madison wants to know what causes thunder snow.
Wow, yeah. We haven't, we don't get that often. But thunder snow is just when you're having a snowstorm and you also have thunder with it. And that thunder is caused by the same types of processes that generate thunder during the summertime when it's raining, and that is ice crystals colliding with liquid water droplets, and it's much like the, you know, generating an electric spark when you rubber against wool or something like that. One gets charged up and then it releases it through a bolt of lightning.
It's just less likely in the winter because the types of air mass that can develop thunderstorms are less common in the wintertime at our latitude. So, but once in a while, they intrude from the south, and they get ingested into a storm, and that's exactly
because
what happens.
It's always neat.
Yeah, it's always neat. It's always exciting. And again, it always seems like it's that big, flake, heavy snowfall when I've heard it. Well, it's convective, so it's going
to
be...
Yeah, and it tends to be moisture-laden. Maybe it's a little warm to get close to that kind of air and so on. Yeah, there's all sorts of reasons why that might be true.
Yeah.
But I love it because the thunder is muffled if it's snowing heavily.
Right, right.
That's cool.
Sound is absorbed by all the snowflakes.
Bob in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know why we always measure snowfall in inches when there's such a variance in the water content of the snowfall. It would seem like we would do better with equivalent inches of water for our snowfall rather than inches of snowfall.
We actually do both.
Yeah.
So we measure it in inches and then melt it and determine how much liquid water that was as well.
Yeah, the official precipitation amount comes in the liquid equivalent. But and there isn't a standard ratio for snow to rain. That's why you can't just rely on just a liquid equivalent amount and then be able to reconstruct the snowfall. You try your best to measure the snow as it's falling, but rely for the climate record for precipitation on the liquid equivalent.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. November 11th, that's coming up. That's going to mark the 100th anniversary of the terrible Armistice Day storm. And what made that storm so deadly?
I don't think it was quite as deadly as the one in 1940, which was very similar, as well as to the storm that sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald. And we just get really cold air coming out off of the, I mean, really strong fronts. I mean, there were 60-degree temperature changes across these fronts. And when you get big temperature changes like that, you get generally really strong wind. And then people aren't prepared for it, particularly in 1911 and 1940. You begin with weathers in the mid-60s, and then you know it, you're in the 20s. You're caught outside.
There's no way to know that's coming in 1911. And then I guess they had a tornado in Racine and then 6 inches of snow on top of it, or something like that. Or maybe it was Janesville. I forget which
Janesville.
Town.
It was Janesville. Just right near Janesville.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and the storm from the 40s was, I mean, it caught so many duck hunters.
Yeah, that's
many
that
people
storm,
outside. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that storm killed over 150 people. And that's the same storm that took down the Tacoma Narrows Bridge.
Yeah, that's
bridge.
Right. Several days earlier, right?
Yeah. So that big bridge waffling around, that was the same storm.
Oh my goodness.
So we can have some November snow. And aren't they forecasting potential snowfall here in another 84 hours or something like that?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't paid attention.
I just saw an email pass around where somebody showed a weather map.
I'll have
saying,
to take a look at that when I get back to the office.
Wanting
that
to know if it's our term next.
The month of November
in the southern part of the state.
Yeah, in the southern part of the state.
The month of November is a historically and notoriously stormy month for the Great Lakes states.
Well, I know northern Wisconsin. I mean, we've already had some snow up there.
Oh, mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
I saw some photos of that people had sent of snow.
They'll have lake effect at the end of the week in Cleveland and Buffalo area this week, so it's going to be a little bit of winter around the eastern half of the United States.
And it's about time.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And Reverend Anthony sent something on Facebook. He said he used to live in Minocqua, so we missed seeing the northern lights. Mm. Now that I live in Green Bay, all I have to look forward to is the Packers.
Yeah.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
That is something to look forward to.
Thanks, Anthony. And Steve and John, thank you.
Thank you.
Time flew. The last Monday of November. I wonder what day that is.
I guess I don't know myself.
It's a
Monday.
We won't worry about it. It's a
Monday. Maybe something like that.
It's a Monday, and it's the last one. Judith is saying, you should know that. But I don't. Wait a minute. Last Monday of the month. November 28th.
November 28th.
She had it. She was thinking ahead, as always, and I wasn't. She even had it written down on a piece of paper, and I overlooked it. November 28th. We'll have you guys back. Thanks.
All right.
Great. All right. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, they will be back, our weather guys, and we will do it all over again with them on November 28th. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.